There's a code of silence, and it can't go on.
Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix.
But getting back to holding on to your sanity, it hasn't stopped, and it won't stop, because there's a war upon you, a complete war. Many of the organizations in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, big organizations, and so-called respectable organizations, their own institutes, etc., they came out as to their agenda and what they wanted to do. It's not conspiracy when they publish their big, big plans to the general populace. And when you quote them back today, you just quote what they've published, you're suddenly a conspiracy theorist. That's a simple technique of ridiculing you, isn't it? Very simple. Just too simple, in fact. I haven't read tonight about Carl Quigley, who, I just looked up his wiki again to see what they said. And they're already trying to whitewash the comments, actually more than comments, wrote books about it, about the round table societies and the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations and so on, because he was the historian. They have their own archives and their own professional historians writing their version of history. And no wonder, it's a better version of history than the rubbish they decide to give you. And I'm not kidding about that, that's a fact. And he was all for their agenda too. In his own, but now they're trying to whitewash it, saying, well, he just had some strange ideas being an Irish descendant. And so, and this is no kidding you in the wiki, because he was too open about it all. And he published a big book, Tragedy and Hope, in the Anglo-American establishment, and laid a lot of it out in the line, including how it started up in England, London, with the Milner Group and the Cecil Rhodes Foundation, which merged together with a big, big agenda. And don't think for an instant that this was all to do with the creation of some white supremacist thing running the world. It was not at all. That's the big joke. And it also was to bring in a whole world system of governing. But it was also to enrich those who set it up, even more than they were already enriched, by grabbing resources. And of course they and their own families and offspring would manage and own these resources, you see, as the nations were used to go across the world. Just like they're still going today, using the US, grabbing oil fields and all the rest of it, and mineral rights and you name it. Hasn't stopped. Behind every great sounding cause, there's always a big con going on.
Realize, first off the bat, the first thing you realize is this entire system containing many systems is completely out of your control. Completely out of your control. Everything that you need and depend upon to live is outside of your control in this system. And you learn very quickly there is no complaints department anywhere. You know very, very quickly that democracy is an utter sham. Not because you guess it, because you've done your homework, you've read the books by Carol Quigley and others who tell you it's a sham. And he knew because he had the records and was the historian for the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a parallel government, not responsible to any voter. And they are simply the American branch of the Royal Institute on International Affairs that was set up to bring in global governance a long time ago. And not just governance, but I say a new sci-fi type society.
But anyway, as I say, was part of their plank of the Communist Manifesto, destruction of the family unit. And then they would have their planned society. I guess they also wanted to decide who would breed and who would not breed too, if they could bring it into full production that way, their whole plan and agenda. But as I say, in the West, they had to use a different tactic. And they tailor-made them slightly different from each other, from Britain to the US and so on, according to the present cultures that they had. Now, remember, Carl Quigley was the historian and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Carl Quigley was all for whatever they did. Now, remember, the Council on Foreign Relations works with its daddy in Britain, which is the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Remember, it's the Royal Institute for International Affairs. If you're all thinking it's just like another communist organization, it's got a royal charter to exist. It's above government, you might say. And it says here in Tragedy and Hope on page 1263, it says, behind this protective barrier, a new teenage culture has grown up. This is in the 60s he's talking about. Its chief characteristic is rejection of parental values and of middle-class culture. What a coincidence, eh? It's all coincidences we're reading here. In many ways, this new culture was like that of the African tribes. Its tastes in music and the dance, its emphasis on sex play, its increasingly scanty clothing, its emphasis on group solidarity, the high value it puts on interpersonal relations, especially talking and social drinking, and drug taking, I should add to it. It's almost total rejection of future preference and constant efforts to free itself. Just tying a few things together to show people that nothing happens by itself. Nothing in any major scale happens by itself. It takes coordination of various sciences. It takes cooperation definitely of big academia. It takes cooperation between the entertainment industry and popular television and so on, all to all work together to cause cultural changes in society. And we're influenced more by fiction than we are by anything else, believe it or not. Fiction really, it's like monkey see, monkey do. Plato said the same thing about drama on the stage in ancient Greece. So it says here, here's Carl Quigley talking about, and remember, he was for this agenda, he worked for this agenda, and he was a professor himself, and he thought it was just swell that it seemed to be going to plan. And he's talking about how the children suddenly, and it was a sudden thing, how they rejected the old values suddenly, because it was a trendy thing to do, obviously. And they were copying the culture like that of the African tribes. Now I can remember reading about ways that the communists could possibly do this, and they were going into things like dance. And if they could break all the old traditional dances, which actually required you to hold the partner, no kidding, that's how it used to be. Amazing, eh? You used to hold the person, since that was the whole point of it. And then suddenly they're dancing apart, steering each other's knees. But they brought that in very successfully, but they copied it from African dancing, basically. And they also used the beat as well to try and bring on the sexual stimulation of the African tribal dances as well. And so they used, as I say, anthropologists big time in the culture industry at this particular period. Getting back to the book, though, it says here, they started to put dressing in scanty clothing, the heavy emphasis on sex play, emphasis on group solidarity. We're all together. We're a different species from the old species. Basically, that's what they thought, you know. And they're told by the communists in America, don't trust anybody over 30. So don't listen to them, in fact, over 30. And then it says here, and the high value it puts on interpersonal relations, especially talking and social drinking. It's almost total rejection of future preference and its constant efforts to free itself from the tyranny of time. They were always stones, so they could never turn up for anything. Teenage solidarity and sociality, especially the solidarity of their groups and subgroups, are amazingly African in attitudes as they gather at nightly or at least on weekends to drink cokes, talk, intermingle interminably in the midst of throbbing music, preferably in semi-darkness with couples drifting off for sex play in the corners as a kind of social diversion and a complete emancipation from time. Usually they have their own language. That was all given to them too. They didn't know that, of course, with vocabulary and constructions so strange that parents find them almost incomprehensible. This Africanization of American society is gradually spreading with the passing years to higher age levels in our culture and is having profound and damaging effects on the transfer of middle-class values to the rising generation. a myriad of symbolic acts over the last 20 years have served to demonstrate the solidarity of teen culture and its rejection of middle-class values. Many of these involve dress and dating customs, both major issues in the adolescent parental Cold War. Interesting term, eh? Adolescent parental Cold War. And it says, dating, as part of the adolescent rebellion, became less and less formalized. The formal middle-class dance of a generation ago, arranged weeks ahead with a dance program, became almost obsolete. Everything had to be totally casual, or today's youth rejects it. By 1947, a dance program listing the dances in numbered order with the girl's partner for each written down was obsolete. Going steady, which meant dancing only with the boy who invited her, became established as it was a complete rejection of the middle-class dance, whose purpose was to provide the girl with a maximum number of different partners in order to widen her acquaintance with matrimonial possibilities. Going steady, like much of adolescent culture of the jive era, was derived from the gangster circles of South Chicago. It wasn't in all the movies, eh? And was first introduced to middle-class knowledge through George Raft movies, that was gangster movies, of the 1930s. It was satirized in a now-forgotten popular song of the 1920s called I Want to Dance with the Guy What Brung Me. The Guy What Brung Me. Yeah. By 1947, it was a way of life of much of adolescent America. As a consequence, teenage couples at high school dances sat out most of the evening in bored silence or chatted in a desultory fashion with friends of the same sex. The jive language of the period also had a South Chicago origin and has been traced back to a large extent to a saloon run by a certain local oracle called Hip early in the 20th century. Fortunately, going steady was only a brief, if drastic, challenge to potential attitudes and was soon replaced by tribal gregariousness and tolerant sexual broad-mindedness, which might be called clique-going. Since it evolved social solidarity, sometimes sexual promiscuity, within a small group, usually of 10 or less, this became, to their adults, the teenage gang, which still strives or thrives, but never in a very formal way in middle-class circles, as it does in lower-class ones. Two casualties of this process are sexual jealousy and sexual privacy, both of which have largely disappeared amongst many upper-middle-class young people. Now, that's what the communists said, too, they do away with jealousy and so on, and you'd have no steady partner. So here we are with this thing. Well, I say I'm not going to terrify people about it, because if we're getting any truth at all, the death rate isn't as high as the people thought. It doesn't mean it can't jump, etc. As I say, there's a lot to come out of this. A lot will come out of this, including the way you're going to live. And that's really the big gain for those at the top. It's like any war, remember, as Carl Quigley said, Professor Quigley, he said that it affects all sides culturally. You can get more done on cultural change. He's talking about planned change, where you want to take a society on all sides, he says. You can get more done in 5 years of war as government takes over everything. Food supply, everything. Education, name it. Than you can do in 50 years of propaganda and peace. Well, this scenario is a type of war scenario. You see, it's a survival scenario. That's how it's put it across all, you know, experts. And it's all to save you all. And out of this, they might, because everything I've watched in the last few years especially has been almost that of a totalitarian order. It doesn't matter what's the climate, massive climate change. Armies have paid people to protest and everything. It's astonishing to watch all this happening. You've got to understand, there have been people for generations, at the very least, probably even older, but for generations, who've planned this. They're often mistaken for communists. And they'll work with communists, as, again, Carl Quigley said. As long as they're on the same agenda, same role, the same general role, that they'll go along with it all and they'll work for it. So all sides are controlled, as I say, by the same capstone, it seems. But it's astonishing to see it all manifest openly in writing and what they're teaching them in universities and all specialized departments. Right down to psychology departments where they talk about the necessity of accepting a form of difference between individuals. They don't want to see you as individual. You're lumped into IQ levels, basically, and socioeconomic status, etc. That's how they've lumped us all in, categorized us through polls and God knows what else. All through your life, from the day that you go to kindergarten all the way to, you know, through your life. The data on you is extraordinary and terrifying, really. But now they're realizing, because to get all this agenda through amongst who's the heaviest targeted group in globalism at the moment, with sustainability and global warming, climate change, and the death of millions of species, blah, 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 of animals and plants, yeah, all that propaganda. Who has been targeted? Because they have to be the future, the children. So in academia, they're admitting they have to treat it a bit differently with the children, because the one thing that they didn't figure out when they're indoctrinating all the children to be a future generation that will never question global warming or sustainability or climate change or anything, is that their hope and the destruction of religion, by the way, in the Western countries, definitely for the traditional religion's gone. Eventually, I guess they'll catch on to other ones too. It'll take a little bit of time, but that's what they plan. But what they've got is nihilism now. They didn't count on nihilism being. They thought all the electronic gadgetry and the transfixion and addiction to cell phones and tablets, etc., would keep them going. But they found out there's nihilism now. With all the bad news of the future, my God, overpopulation and everyone's dying and all that nonsense, which it isn't, you know. And then you find that, yeah, you've got nihilism and depression amongst children now, and suicides. So they're coming out with all kinds of strategies under various categories, and one of them's called hope. Trying to get instill hope along with the propaganda to keep the children going, so they'll grow up without being totally nihilistic. And they themselves, by the way, once you give them reasons that, oh, almost like a religion, will overcome, we can overcome all these problems, but remember that humans are the heart of the problem. Well, I tell you, I can see they'd be utterly ruthless, those children, when they grow up, if they're given this kind of hope, because it'll be a religion to them, and they'll be ruthless to anyone who doesn't tolerate the propaganda. It's already in the air again in this day and age, as we know. It's way past the point of dissuasion, as far as I'm concerned, because most of the public have never even been informed that this has even been going on, this big war-type propaganda battle by a very old agenda. A technique, for instance, of making you listen to authority figures. And Carl Quigley talked about this awfully, awfully well in a conversation he had, which is out there on YouTube land somewhere, I think, where he talks to a student about this, about what to say and what not to say, and what he used to do. He used to get pulled in as part of a team for the big television stations when someone else was coming out and exposing documentation, documented proof that something was going on inside America, for instance, that the public should know about, since supposedly the government's supposedly there to supposedly serve the public. A lot of supposing indeed. But people really took that seriously, and nothing was supposed to be done to change their system without the public's consent, at least on paper. And so Quigley said that he was pulled in on one of the many times he was pulled in as an expert, along with a panel who were also pulled in to debate someone who came out with a conspiracy theory or whatever. And he admitted, and this occasion that happened, this one occasion, he said they went in with the usual cocky stance, ready for anything, and to mock someone and poo-poo them and laugh at them. But this one parent, I think it was Gary Allen, in a book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. And he said this guy had his information down, he knew his stuff, he knew his history, he delved into it. And that shocked them, because his job, as I say, was to go in there and laugh them out of existence. That's how you're trained to follow experts, you see. Another technique they'll use often today, I've noticed, is when something happens, you're given a thousand different reasons for it happening until you just give up. Most folk will just give up. They don't have the time or the lifespan to learn all this stuff. So they just give up and go with the official view of something. That's very typical today. They actually did documents, they put out documents a few years back on this technique and how to use it for those in officialdom. So we live in an amazing system of psychopolitics, psychowarfare, and psychological techniques used all the time, not just by advertising, but pretty well everything out there. And we've never lived in a time when there really has been freedom. You've always had these battles going on, even with newspapers in the past. That's why you had newspaper cartels. And Carl Quigley, who was all for this new system we're coming into, and who worked for it, and trained civil servants for the State Department in the US in what was to come, and gave them a higher reality than he even put in his books of where it was all supposed to go. He's all for it, and he was a member of the CFR, of course, and flirted with the trilaterals too, but he was also the historian for a while. They have their own separate history of his, and he said he took over from Alfred Zimmerman, who had been a historian for a long time, who was also one of the top communists, by the way. They don't care what they call themselves at the top, because the goal is for a socialistic control over all of society, run by experts, just like communism had always planned to do, but never quite got there, you know. And what we have today is the super communism system, where they don't even need a physical revolution for it now. All those revolutions have been done. In the West, they use the sexual revolution, the destruction of family units, all the same tenets of communism. And then the state taken over to take care of the chaos and the fallout from it all. It's all been done pretty well. But now you're into the training side of it. Aside, they knew it'd come. As I said, the old Red Bishop of Britain at one time, he was an Archbishop, but I've got his book somewhere. But 1940s, he literally talked about lifelong education. And I read his book, and I'm still slapping my head, saying, what is he getting at? Your lifelong education will be the norm. Because I knew that most folk, once they've been through school and the working class system, they don't want to go back to school and all that kind of stuff, you know. It didn't make, so he wasn't talking about going back to school, although he did mention that eventually they'd bring in retraining. What they meant, literally, it was lifelong training of each person right till you die. They would take away your ability to choose what you wanted to know even and think about, etc. You'd be given a set of choices, where all safe choices to pass your time, to play with, like not reading novels and so on. But in reality, you were always going to be shaped and put along a certain path of thinking. Everybody in the nation of Britain, or the country of Britain, or the kingdom of Britain, whatever you want to call it, would go through the same process. And then everybody in the world would go through it too. It seemed so far-fetched that most folk couldn't quite grasp it. And at that time, they thought it was more communistic, a communistic type thing. Because only the communists at that time were using the Pavlovian techniques in the school and the using the all different techniques for conditioned responses that would come from the students through indoctrinated processes. From myself, Alan Ward, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.